Well, let's thank the Lord and begin. Our gracious God, we thank you for your kindness to us. I pray that as we consider these things, as we work through these issues, that you would give us clarity and charity of heart. I pray you watch over us and keep us. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, this workshop is entitled Defending Sayers' Insight. So I'm not going to be talking about Sayers' Insight or applying it. My first workshop was sort of reviewing the basics of classical Christian education. This is going to be a little bit different. In what follows, I'm going to be interacting a great deal with a book entitled Wisdom and Eloquence, a book I really enjoyed reading. So this is there's going to be some critical interaction, but I want the critical interaction to be understood to be functioning in the context of appreciating the book as a whole and appreciating a lot of good things about it. Both the book was co-authored by Robert Littlejohn and Charles Evans, and they're both experienced educators, and their shrewd experience shines through in many of the passages of the book. It's a well-written book, and it's got certain chapters in it that should be read and reread by all educators seeking to provide a classical and Christian education. Chapter 8 on the rhetoric curriculum is an example of it. Another good example would be the Appendix B, A Brief History of the Liberal Arts in the Public Square. These and other extended passages are quite valuable, and there's good information here for everyone involved in the work of recovering a classical Christian education. So this is a good book for all classical Christian educators. You can sum up my general sentiments with Wisdom and Eloquence as a book, rah. But there is a significant disagreement, and this disagreement is going to be the focus of my talk, and I think it will be apparent over as the talk unfolds why we need to talk about it and what we're going for here. In this talk, I'm going to be following very closely an article I wrote on this same subject that appeared in Classis, and Littlejohn and Evans' views are represented in their book. Some people assumed, and when I originally wrote the article, I assumed that this was also the stance of the Society for Classical Learning, SCL, which is another association of classical Christian schools. But after I wrote the article that appeared in Classis, SCL asked to reprint the article in their newsletter, which they did. And then the publisher of the newsletter said, basically, as an organization, SCL, where do we stand in this discussion debate? And she said something like, we stand on the sidelines cheering, you know. We're not participating in this. SCL doesn't necessarily sign on with what we're doing or with what Littlejohn and Evans argue for in their book at this particular point. Now, at the point of discussion, at the point of debate, there's a great deal that we share in common, and I don't want that commonality to be lost in the discussion. It's important to emphasize these agreements, at least for an ACCS audience, because it exhibits a central pedagogical disagreement that has arisen in the world of classical Christian education between the ACCS application of Dorothy Sayers' insight in the lost tools of learning and the approach argued for in Wisdom and Eloquence. So SCL doesn't take sides on this particular pedagogical debate, but ACCS does take sides on this pedagogical debate. ACCS is committed to a particular approach that we find Dorothy Sayers arguing for in her foundational essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. In addition to its other strengths, Wisdom and Eloquence provides the valuable service of displaying exactly what that disagreement is. But before discussing this, it's important to note that this is a difference of pedagogical opinion, and it's not part of the battle between light and darkness. It would be a sorry business if classical Christian educators with so much in common got into a snarl over any of this. This is not snarl-worthy. At the same time, if you open a school, you're going to have to decide what to do. Right? There are certain things that you don't necessarily believe are of first importance in your cosmic scheme of things. But once you attempt to do something practical, you have to decide from day one what you're going to do. So, for example, I have certain theological convictions. I'm a minister. I have certain theological convictions that are dear to me, that I think are at the center of the gospel and I think are very important. But someone could come to my church for a year and a half before finding out that I thought those things. I might not be preaching a series of sermons that would address them, or they could come for some time without knowing what was something of first importance to me. But the first week they came, they would encounter the songs we picked. Right? Now, the songs we picked are not of first importance. They are much farther down the register of importance, but that's the first thing that people will encounter. All right, so there are certain things that are very important to you as a school, but that's not what your parents are going to encounter when they enroll their child first thing. You're going to have to make decisions of a practical nature from the get-go, and you're going to have to decide which way you're going to go. The fact that you have to decide which way you're going to go and you have to make a decision doesn't mean that this is something worthy of breaking fellowship with people over. But you still have to decide. So, in order to talk about this, I need to speak autobiographically for a moment. This is a difference. This difference remains, and it has very practical ramifications. But in order for me to set forth this difference appropriately, it's necessary for me to back up and to give some background history. When I was a young sailor, I was single and without a thought of educational issues in my head. That idea had never occurred to me. I did not think I was going to be a teacher or an educator. That was not on the menu. When I was a young sailor in this condition, when I was in high school, I'd begun subscribing to National Review, William Buckley's magazine, and I kept my subscription up when I was off in the service. And they periodically reprinted or would reprint or run as an article Dorothy Sayers' essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. I subscribed to the magazine. It came. I read it. And I thought, huh. And that was that. A few years later, though, I was out of the Navy. I got married the same year I got out of the Navy. And a few years after that, we had a young daughter, Becca, toddling around the home. One day, my wife, Nancy, when Becca was 2 or 3 years old, my wife, Nancy, told me that she could not see handing Becca over to someone that we didn't know and saying something like, here she is, teach her about everything. All right? And we just couldn't see it. Now, what I knew about education, Christian education, the pedagogical assumptions about education, the approach to education, what I knew about that subject at that time approached zero. I had not been preparing myself to be an educator. But what happened is we got married and we started having children. And Samuel Johnson, the writer of the first English dictionary, or the first famous English dictionary, said one time, there's one good thing about being hanged in a fortnight. He said, it concentrates the mind wonderfully. Always look on the bright side. Well, here we're married, and we have this kid, and we're parents, and we're responsible. What do you think about education? And Nancy told me what she thought. She said, I can't see handing her over to non-believers and saying, here she is, teach her about everything. Well, there were no real Christian education options for us in Moscow at that time. There was a teeny tiny Seventh-day Adventist school, and there was a Roman Catholic grade school, and that was it. So I told Nancy, I don't know why I told Nancy, but I told Nancy, don't worry, we will have a Christian school started by the time Becca hits kindergarten. You know, so she's 2 or 3 now. She's going to get, we'll have something going by the time she hits kindergarten. So work began on this very important project. And when our founding board began discussing what kind of education that we should seek to provide, we knew what we didn't want. We knew that we didn't want a fundamentalist reactionary academy, and we knew that we didn't want a compromised prep school. So we didn't want a private Tony prep school where you got all the same unbelief that you got at the government school, only with lots of money involved. And we didn't want a reactionary, truncated retreat from culture fundamentalist school. So we came up with the motto, a classical and Christ-centered education. A classical and Christ-centered education. The classical meant that it wasn't fundamentalist and reactionary. The Christ-centered meant that it wasn't a compromised, unbelieving prep school. We didn't know what that meant, but we knew what it didn't mean. We knew that it didn't mean the things we didn't want, but it positively, what did we mean by classical and Christ-centered? Somewhere in this process, I remembered having read that article in National Review when I was in the Navy. So we tracked down a copy of the essay again, and with the view that this represented considerably more wisdom than we knew about at the time, we adopted it and resolved to give it a try. All right? It's not either of the two things that we don't want. We don't know what it is positively, but let's go for it. It's better than what we've got right now. Now, the heart of Sayers' essay is her application of the trivium. Now, note the word application. This is her application of the trivium. Grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric to the natural stages of child development. That's the heart of her argument. All right? The heart of her argument is we take the trivium, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, and let's apply it to the stages of child development that the kids naturally grow up through. Her argument is that the trivium should be applied in a foundational way, giving the kids the tools of learning, after which point they can go on to complete the seven liberal arts in their study of the quadrivium. So the trivium comes first, grammar first, then dialectic, then rhetoric, and then you can go on to study the quadrivium. Now, at the time, we could not have told you anything about the history of the trivium and its relationship to child development other than what we had read in Sayers. So everything we knew about the trivium, we knew about from Sayers. But what we did know from Sayers, we put into practice. So I am confessing to you that we began from a position of ignorance about classical Christian history, pedagogy. We just didn't know. So we were just taking what we could from Sayers and put it into practice. And the results were astonishing. The practical results from this were just astonishing. It was like it's like striking oil. It's like, whoa. You know, this is way beyond what we... This is great. This is fantastic. Now, when we began to do this, of course, we began to study and research and learn more about what it was we were engaged in doing, but we began with Sayers' application. Now, Sayers in the article says that she is in the highest degree confident that no one will ever attempt what she's writing about. I don't know if you noticed that little comment. Nobody, that's probably because she was Oxford educated and knew a bunch of reasonable people. She didn't take into account the possibility of unreasonable Americans who were in a desperate situation who said, hey, I read an article, let's try this. So we did. And it caught fire, it started to go. We were just thrilled at what began to happen. Logos began in the early 80s. By the early 90s, we'd been going for 10 years, and that's when I got the opportunity to write the book, Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning. So when I wrote that, we had 10 years of experience with the school and enough to really just be thrilled with what we saw happening. And in the time since then, it's gotten deeper and richer and better, and it's just amazing. Now, a lot rides on whether we describe what Sayers was advocating as her historical explication of the medieval practice, or, instead of this, describing it as the Sayers insight. Okay? Is this Sayers' interpretation and recounting of what the medievals did, or is this Sayers saying, hey, look what the medievals did, and I'm suggesting that we apply it in a new and unique way? So Sayers, is this Sayers' explication or is this Sayers' insight? What somebody really ought to try sometime for the first time. Now, Littlejohn and Evans, in their book, point out, and I think rightly, in my view, this is one of the central things they argue for, they point out rightly that the historical application of the trivium did not do it the Sayers way. All right? The historical application of the trivium was not done on the Sayers model. In other words, I don't believe that the little kids in 1352 who were taken into a school were taken through the grammar stage, the way they are in our schools, and then on to the dialectic stage, and then on to the rhetoric stage. Little John and Evans point out accurately that that's not how it was done. So when we're returning to the trivium, we are returning to these categories, but we are returning to these categories as applied in a unique and insightful way by Dorothy Sayers. So this, when we talk about the Sayers insight, we are talking about Sayers, the intuitive pedagogical master, not Sayers, the historian. Okay? In my book, The Case for Classical Christian Education, which was published in 2003, so a little over 10 years after Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, I refer repeatedly to the Sayers insight. And this is the reason I was referring to it this way. All right, so when I refer to the Sayers insight, I'm referring to it for this reason. Now, I believe that Little John and Evans are quite correct on that historical point. In other words, if we look to Sayers for how they were doing it back in the day, or back in the medieval day, I think we're going to miss the mark. All right, if we think that Sayers is talking about how schools operated in 1352, we are going to miss the mark. But if we look to Sayers for a valuable idea on how this approach to the trivium could and should be applied in modern education, we will find ourselves cooking with propane. And that's a good thing, cooking with propane. And we'll be extremely pleased with the results. And this is exactly what happened to us. I've got a few quotes from The Case for Classical Christian Education emphasizing certain things, just so that you can see that this... When Little John and Evans are arguing for this, that when Sayers is talking about the trivium, she's not accurately representing what they did in the Middle Ages, I agree with what Little John and Evans are saying, but this is something that we already knew. Right? This is something that we came to grips with. In the first quote on page 84, I say, "The pedagogy refers to our commitment to Dorothy Sayers' basic insight that children grow naturally through stages that correspond nicely with the three elements of the trivium. The Cassiodorus and the medieval educators provided us with the trivium. Sayers provided us with the insight that, hey, look what how kids grow up, and this matches up nicely." On page 135 of The Case for Classical Christian Education, I say, "Sayers offered us a remarkable pedagogical insight." Then on page 136, the Sayers' insight for all ages could be summed up this way: teach with the grain. When kids are ready for grammar, give them grammar. When they're ready for dialectic, give them dialectic. When they're ready for rhetoric, give them rhetoric. On page 209, in The Case for Classical Christian Education, I say the structure I would propose is that of the medieval trivium as developed and applied by Dorothy Sayers. So Dorothy Sayers takes this medieval structure, and then she makes a unique contribution. Now, what alternative is being proposed in Wisdom and Eloquence? A proposed departure from this is a significant part of the argument presented in Wisdom and Eloquence, and the point is reiterated a number of times. In short, the central contribution that Sayers has to offer, in my view, is the major thing that Little John and Evans take issue with. Now, this is not the end of the world, as I indicated earlier, and I'm sure that both of these gentlemen remain very fine educators despite disagreeing with Sayers on this. If you disagree with Sayers on this, that doesn't make you a bad teacher or a bad educator. But it does represent a significant disagreement, one that every school is going to have to confront and decide which way they're going to go. Well, what are we going to do here? It represents a significant disagreement within the classical and Christian education world, and every classical Christian school needs to decide what they're going to do at this point, because you can't do both. Right? You can't emphasize these different stages and keep them distinct in the main, and not keep them distinct in the in the main. You just can't do both. Both of them are fine dances, but you can't waltz and do the Texas two-step at the same time. Although Ty Willis, who's on the ACCS board and is here at Regents School in Austin, would probably maintain that you should be doing the Texas two-step all the time. But you can't do both dances at the same time. For their part, Little John and Evans want to separate the arts from the question of cognitive development altogether. So they don't want to talk about the trivium and child development at all. Right? Those two things don't mix as far as they're concerned. You can see that on page 39 of their book. I'd like to read a few other quotes from their book so you can see what we're talking about here. On page 34, they say, however, the experience we've gained through these efforts, combined with our own research into the historical development of the classical liberal arts and sciences, and our close reexamination of her own assertions, have led us to disagree with portions of Ms. Sayer's proposal and with the way her recommendations have been attempted at some schools. Now, the schools that are attempting this would be our schools. We're the ones attempting this. We're the ones doing this. They say on page 74, on the contrary, the tradition handed us by our forebears says little to nothing about pedagogy while saying everything about the curriculum. The trivium is not a pedagogical paradigm, but a collection of disciplines. That's page 74. And they, on page 115, they say, as we have indicated in an earlier chapter, we reject the spurious notion that the trivium is foundational to the quadrivium. They don't see it as part of a progression. Okay? Now, as I've noted above, there's a significant amount of agreement in this disagreement. Okay, there's a significant amount of agreement in this disagreement. I agree, and we agree, at ACCS, that child development was not in view 8 centuries ago. Right? We agree that child development was not in view 8 centuries ago. We agree that in the medieval period, the trivium were 3 subjects, not 3 stages of development. We agree on that historical datum. But suppose we reject the Sayers' point considered as historical exegesis, and incidentally, I'm not saying that Sayers got the exegesis wrong. I'm saying that I'm not at all convinced she was doing exegesis. I think she's giving us her insight. Hey, let's try this. So let's say we reject the Sayers' point as historical exegesis, but we go on to accept it considered as a new proposed pedagogical paradigm. Let's say we call it Sayers' unique proposal. Right? Sayers' unique proposal using historical elements, but not reproducing or reenacting what they were doing. The people who tried this in the early 80s in North Idaho didn't know any different. So they just went for it. Okay, if you'd asked me in 1982 whether this was an insight or an application, I wouldn't have known then. I just would have known we're trying this. But as we studied and got feedback and read more about it, it began to unfold that this is the case. So we applied it as a suggestion, regardless of whether it was in the 80s, 40 years old, or 400 years old. We couldn't have told you if it was 40 years old or 400 years old. We just knew that it was wiser than we were at the moment, and we tried it. And we have been extremely pleased with the consequences. So we've been delighted with the practical results of the Sayers' insight. But there's an additional argument. So there's a positive argument. Hey, it works. It's doing what we wanted to do. But there's another argument for applying the Sayers' insight. It's an additional argument against going back to a purist historical view of the trivium. One of the central reasons why we should not just return to the trivium as it was in the medieval period is because it used to be a pretty confusing hodgepodge. All right? It used to be all messed up. Now, I'm going to allude to this later, but basically we want to be historically informed, historically grounded, historically rooted, but we don't want to be starry-eyed golden agers. Right? Starry-eyed golden agers are people who say, it was always better in the old days. Right? It was always better back in the day. It was always better back then. Well, actually, education in the Middle Ages was atrocious in a lot of ways. And they didn't have a lot of sympathy for kids, and if you were a promising student, they just threw you into the subjects, and most people were illiterate and couldn't read at all. And the problems they were, the problems they encountered with educating sons of the wealthy or gifted, exceptionally gifted kids who could sort out, who could make their way through these various subjects in a sink or swim way, is not the same situation we're in. The simultaneous inculcation of grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, along with the quadrivium, is something that could get away from you pretty easily, and in the Middle Ages, it certainly did. All right, so there are all kinds of jumbles that occurred in medieval education. Reading this book by Little John and Evans makes me think that they have it well in hand. In other words, I don't think it's gotten away from them, but partly because we live in an age where education is graded. Right? We have gradations in education, and it didn't used to be that way. And Little John and Evans haven't rejected the stages of child development. They haven't rejected the graded education. What they've rejected is mingling it with the trivium. They say the trivium is one thing, graded education is another. But they've not abandoned gradation. But even though Little John and Evans have it well in hand, this is more than could be said for some early forms of it. This tangled medieval mess was addressed by the Moravian bishop and educational reformer John Amos Comenius when he first introduced the idea of pedagogical gradation. So it wasn't until the tail end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Reformational Age that the idea of prerequisites came into existence. John Amos Comenius invented the idea of pedagogical gradation and introduced it as an educational reformer. If you want to know more about Comenius, if the book's still there, I noticed that on the Standfast book table, George Grant's book table, they've got a book about Comenius. This is how I addressed it in the case for classical Christian education. One of the important things we owe to Comenius is the systematic development of a natural gradation in the curriculum. This is of special interest to classical educators who are following Sayers in her application of the trivium to the stages of child development. So Comenius introduces at the tail end of the medieval period the idea of gradation, and Sayers is suggesting that we conduct the gradation according to this pattern of the trivium in the Middle Ages, but they weren't doing that in the Middle Ages. So, following this, also in the case for classical Christian education, I quote Keating as he summarizes what we actually owe to Comenius, which is a good deal. If the reader wishes to realize with any force to what extent the gradation and proper articulation of studies was neglected, or rather unthought of, when Comenius was writing, let him read a few chapters in the Great Dialectic, Comenius, and then turn to Milton's Tractate of Education. In the one, he will find a rigorous distribution of the subject matter of instruction based on an analysis of the capacity and age of the scholar and on a common sense estimate of the difficulty of the subject. In the other, that is, in Milton's, in the other he meets with breadth of mind, it is true, but with no scheme of gradation whatever. So if you were a genius, as John Milton most certainly was, and they threw you into the deep end of the pool, as they did, what would you do? Well, you'd figure out how to swim, right? But not everybody did that. Let me come at this another way with a modern example. And I've said this before, and it's this is really worth noting. In the Americans, you have probably seen television reports and newspaper reports and so forth on the train wreck that is American government education. But in that, you need to understand that in American government schools, the top 10% of American kids in the American schools are competitive with anybody anywhere in the world. Right? Our top 10% in government schools are getting a superb education. Okay? That's because the top 10% gets a superb education wherever they go. Okay? These are the kinds of kids who can teach themselves to read off of cereal boxes, right? And they teach themselves phonics. Even if the school's not teaching phonics, they figure out phonics for themselves. The problem with our government tax-supported educational system is not that we're crippling the top 10%. Our top 10% are going to do fine, thanks. They're just going to do fine, educationally, academically. Spiritually is another matter, but academically, they're going to do well. Don't shed any tears for them. The disaster that our school system is it's a disaster because of what it does to the lower 90%. 90% of students need a teacher. They need a course to follow. They need someone to hold their hand and walk them through it. Another way of putting this is they need gradation. They need a path that has the steps marked, clearly marked, and they know what to do. Now, what Comenius did is he introduced a system of gradation that made what we see as universal education a possibility. If you just have all the subjects there, all the subjects heaped up, this is what we want everybody to learn, and we have a throw them in the deep end of the pool approach to education, we're going to have 10% of the kids superbly educated. Superbly educated. They're going to be great swimmers. And we're going to have 90% drown. That's what's going to happen. Comenius introduced the idea of systematizing this, studying this, and laying it out in a predictable track so that we could educate more and more people. In the Middle Ages, that was not one of their central concerns. So when Milton is not in the medieval period, but he is functioning with a view of education that's very much inheriting the way they did it in the Middle Ages. And he doesn't have any notion of gradation. Comenius talks about gradation. Sayers comes along and says, hey, let's do the gradation according to the stages of child development, and grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric fit very nicely. This was a thought experiment for her. For us, it was an actual experiment. Right? I've sometimes teased back at my oldest daughter that how does it feel to be a guinea pig? You know, you've been, not only did she do the Logos, but when she graduated from Logos, that was the first year of New St. Andrews, and she went to New St. Andrews with the entering class of four freshmen, and that was the whole school. And she was just a trooper. So, Comenius gives us this idea of gradation. Sayers gives us the idea of gradation using the language and the concepts of the trivium. Just a couple of other comments about this. The first is that we want to make sure that we keep this difference where it ought to be, as a matter of an important emphasis and not as a matter of fundamental substance. There are other Christian schools out there that aren't classical and Christian schools, and they're fine Christian schools. They're good places to be, and you wouldn't mind sending your kids. There are, you would perhaps prefer to have classical Christian education, but it's not that anything that's not classical and Christian is wicked. All right, that's not what we're saying. There are other methods and approaches that that do well. We prefer this. This is what we want to do. This is what we believe God has called us to. But we don't think it's a matter of fundamental substance. We do think it's important for each school to make up its mind on which it's going to do, what it's going to do. But that doesn't mean that we're going to break fellowship over any of this. In other words, every advocate of a graded approach to the trivium acknowledges that none of the three stages are pure, free from all contamination from the other stages. Spelling is taught in the grammar stage, for example, and spelling is a rhetorical matter. Spelling is rhetoric, right? If you could spell a word phonetically that's not the way you spell it, and it looks like you're, and if you spell it that way for the rest of your life, you will look uneducated. It's rhetorically inept. If you spell one as in 1, 2, 3, if you spell it with the W sound on the front, the W, if you spell one, W-U-N, which is how you would if you, English is great. O-U-G-H is O sound in slew, it's O sound in though, it's uff sound in rough, it's off sound in cough, it's, you know, just fun. So if you had a student spell cough, K-O-F-F, right? Well, they were paying attention in phonics, and they weren't listening to the exceptions that you got to later, and they're going to look rhetorically inept for the rest of their life. But they learned that in grade school, so spelling is rhetoric. Spelling is a rhetorical matter. It's important for ACCS educators to recognize that there's no such thing as a pure grammar stage, and then a pure dialectic stage, and then pure rhetoric. These are not watertight categories. These are emphases, right? We emphasize this. We emphasize grammar in the grammar stage, but there are dialectical and rhetorical elements there. We emphasize dialectic in the dialectical stage, but there are still grammatical things that they're learning and rhetorical things that they're picking up. We emphasize rhetoric in the rhetoric stage, but there are still grammar things that they're learning and dialectical things that they are learning. So the Sayers insight means that we emphasize the grammar of all subjects in the elementary years. We emphasize the dialectic of all subjects in the junior high years. And we emphasize the rhetoric of all subjects in the high school years. This is a question of emphasis, not exclusion. So you cannot teach rhetoric and exclude grammar and dialectic. You cannot teach grammar and exclude rhetoric and so on. But of course, each stage is going to have important elements of the others contained within them. They indwell one another. Now, I believe that what Little John and Sayers are arguing is that they indwell one another more completely than we think. They would say, well, I'm not sure that it's possible to isolate and emphasize this way. And if you isolate and emphasize, then we don't know that you ought to emphasize them in this order beginning in the elementary school. And then going the other way, students in the rhetoric years still have to memorize things. Right? They get to a, you know, they get to a certain subject and they have to memorize the periodic table, let's say, in science class. And they're when they're doing that, that's properly speaking a grammatical sort of thing. That's the kind of thing you could have had them do in elementary school, unless you have them memorize the periodic table in elementary school, which is a thought. So students in the grammar stage learn how to make letters that stay within the lines, thus presenting a more pleasing rhetorical effect. For their part, Little John and Evans retain an understanding of the importance of gradation. They just don't tie it together with the language of the trivium. And you can see that on pages 130 and 164. So they're not rejecting gradation. They've inherited the legacy of Comenius, and they're not rejecting that. They just don't want to tie it together with grammar, then dialectic, and then rhetoric in that order through the curriculum. Now, to a certain extent, I think that this is inescapable. Can you imagine what Comenius did for us? I don't think it's possible or desirable to get free of it. It's been a very great blessing. Can you imagine being a business manufacturer and saying, I'm gonna manufacture things and I'm gonna ignore Henry Ford. I'm going to ignore assembly line production, right? Well, it's not going to be possible for you to do it unless you're going to be selling high-end luxury items. I'm going to sell iPods manufactured by hand in my shop by one guy, right? And they're going to cost $15,000 to make it worth my time. Well, you might be able to sell this as a novelty item, but everything in our whole society presupposes assembly line mass production. You can't, once Henry Ford has introduced this, there's not going to be a way that you can figure out to get back behind that. By analogy, in a very real sense, and I don't mean this pejoratively, it's going to sound pejorative, but I don't mean it this way. In a very real sense, Comenius introduced assembly line education, right? He introduced assembly line education, which made it possible for you to make more cars. It made it possible for you to educate more students. Now, of course, there is a sense in which Christians react to and shy away from industrialization of everything and the mechanization of everything and the resultant dehumanization. So if you have these local behemoth high school with 5,000 students in it, and I say, look at that assembly line education there, there's a sense in which that would be pejorative, where the students are coming in one end, this massive students are coming in one end as bipedal carbon units, and they're assigned a number and a locker, and the number of the student has to match the number of the locker, and you process them like it's a food processing plant or something, a knowledge factory, and then they come out of the other end. Well, if they come out the other end, they're going to come out not knowing very much. It's a dehumanized education. So there's a sense in which assembly line production goes bad. Okay, there's a sense in which that goes wrong. It goes off the rails. And for this reason, for example, it's interesting that one of the entities that has kept Comenius was a Christian educator, a Moravian bishop, as I mentioned, but one of the entities that has kept his works in print has been the United Nations. Right? Sort of the liberal establishment looks back to him as a forerunner of sort of our industrialized education. Well, as classical Christian educators, we don't want that. But we want to be able to think through a problem the way we're trying to teach our kids to think through a problem and say, okay, graded education is not entirely bad. Right? There are bad things about it. If you don't watch it, it can get away from you. But if you don't do it, if you don't grade, if you don't segregate kids according to ability and knowledge and so forth, you're going to have this awful jumble. You're going to have problems that way too. These are not new issues. I alluded to this earlier. These are not issues that are new to us or issues that somehow passed us by. In the early years of Logos, we worked through these very same issues when one of our founding board members urged us to adopt an approach very similar to the one argued for here in Wisdom and Eloquence. And he was arguing from a background or a foundation in some of Mortimer Adler's approach to classical Christian education. But this board member, who is a friend of mine to this day, doesn't serve on the board any longer, but he's a good friend and gracious Christian gentleman, but he didn't want grammar here, logic here, and rhetoric there. He wanted all three taught at every level. He wanted to abolish that gradation. So we had to confront this pretty early on in the and after deliberation many years ago, the Logos School Board decided against going this route, and we continue to be extremely satisfied with the results that we continue to see. So we want to dance with the one what brung you, right? If this is an essential part of why we feel so blessed and graced by God, if this has been such a blessing to us, why would we, in a lust for novelty, ditch it and go do something else? Now, the fact that it has been a great blessing to us does not give us the right to deny a historical fact. So, for example, if we applied Sayers' insight, but let's pretend for a moment that we didn't know it was her insight, and we thought it was Sayers, the historian, telling us how it was done in the 14th century, and then we're being greatly blessed by it, and then Little John and Evans write their book, and we argue with them and say, nuh-uh, that is too the way they did it in the 14th century, all right, then we're being dishonest. All right, I think the facts are with them as they argue this. So we don't have the right to deny the truth or to tamper with history just because we like the educational result. But we can believe that God is at work in history. We don't have to believe that that things were always better in the olden days. We don't have to believe that. We can believe that there are good things before us, good things ahead of us. Having said all this, I suppose it means that I believe that the Sayer's insight represents a better application of the medieval trivium than was practiced in the medieval period itself. Okay? Let me say that again because I want you to know that I understand what I'm saying. I believe that Sayer's insight represents a better application of the medieval trivium than was practiced in the medieval period itself. You know the old parental trick of, you know, your oldest kid wants to cut the pie up, you baked a pie, and the oldest kid wants to cut the pie, and you say, sure, you can cut the pie, but you choose the last piece. All right? You share with your brothers and sisters, you cut it up, and then you go last. You apportion it, and you go last. Legal theorist John Rawls, who's not a believing theorist, he this is his application of the golden rule. You should hypothesize the ideal society, not knowing where you're going to be born into it. Right? When you're sketching the ideal society, you don't know if you're going to be a serf, a slave, a king, a courtier. You don't know. And if you, so, it's unlikely. For example, if you give your oldest kid the task of cutting up the pie, it's unlikely he's going to cut three slivers and then one gigantic piece in the hope that it'll still be there when it comes time for him to choose. It's unlikely that you would postulate the ideal society with a king who has unlimited power. In a go-for-broke Las Vegas way, maybe I'll be born into that society and I'll be that king. Yeah, but the odds are likely that you're going to be one of these serfs who live grinding, miserable, terrible lives. Well, we ought to sketch the ideal school system for a commonwealth, for a nation, for a people, if we want to say, okay, what do we want to think is the ideal school system? Not knowing where you're going to have to enroll your kids. Okay? That's what we want to do. So when we, would I rather have my kids in an ACCS school or pick an ACCS school at random and enroll my kids in one of those, or pick a medieval school at random and enroll them in one of those? There'd be no question, right? No question. I really believe that there's been pedagogical educational advance. Now, there's also been, in recent times, a deterioration. Why we're doing what we're doing is because we see that there's a educational modernity has gone wrong in lots of ways. It's gone to seed in a lot of ways. But there were advances over time. It's not like if you believe in historical progress, it doesn't mean that you believe that history takes off like a rocket ship, you know. And it's more like walking up the side of a steep and craggy mountain. You walk up a slope and then down into a gully and then up the slope and then down into the valley and then up the slope, and you've got advances and setbacks. P.G. O'Rourke, the humorist, has said, for anybody who doesn't believe in progress, I can refute them in one word. He said, dentistry. Would you rather have a tooth pulled now? Right? Would you rather have a tooth pulled now or in 1500? Would you rather have your kid enrolled in an average classical Christian school now? And I'm not talking about the plumbing and the bathrooms and how they get to school. I'm not talking about culture generally. I'm simply talking about the education that they're likely to get. Would you rather have them educated where that 90% is going to be taught and brought along, or would you rather have them taught where the elite, the super bright kids, are going to be stellar, but a bunch of others are going to be shoveling out the stables for the rest of their lives because that's all they can do? All right, so So I do believe that we are in a better position than they were in the medieval period, but I don't say this with pride or ingratitude, because had they not done what they did, we wouldn't be where we are. We're standing on their shoulders. We figure these things out as we go. And as Cassiodorus takes the pagan education, he builds the seven liberal arts, the education is established through the medieval period, and I think generally, if you take it in 15-minute bites, 15-year bites, you could have 15 years later be grimmer than before. But if you take it in 250-year bites, right? If you say, is this better or that, this better or that, I think we can generally see that God's being kind to us as a people. So it would follow from all this that I believe schools that follow the Sayers' insight will enjoy richer educational fruit than schools that simply return to the practice of teaching all seven of the liberal arts at every stage. I believe that this is going to bear better fruit. I think this is a better way of doing it. But this is just a disagreement. It's a free country, right? It's just a disagreement. It's a free country. Other folks can do what they think is the best thing to do. And we ought to do what we think is the best thing to do. And this relates to something else. I don't want to go too far afield, but I always think that I'm right. I don't think I'm always right, but I always think I'm right. You see that? I don't think I'm always right, but always when I'm thinking, I think I'm right. And so when someone comes up to you and says, this is classical Christian education, and you read all these books and you think you know it all, you people always think you're right. Now, you shouldn't say this, but you could think to yourself, and you came to me with this rebuke because you thought you were wrong. When someone comes to rebuke you, why are they doing it? Because they think they're right. Everybody thinks they're right. Who doesn't think they're right? No one says, this is the best way to go, but I'm not saying this is true. Right? Everyone who makes a truth claim, and we all make them all day long, does so believing that it's correct. Now, at the same time, we know that sometimes we're mistaken. This is why we have to be humble and open to correction from other people. But when we make a decision believing that this is correct, that's just the nature of human choice. That's just the nature of human decision-making. If we collide with people rather than just differ with them, if we collide with them, we're saying, I think I'm right, and you are in sin because you're not doing this with me. Right? That's a collision. Believing what you believe and implementing what you believe need not be done haughtily or arrogantly at all. This is a significant disagreement with Little John and Evan's book, but it's a disagreement, not a collision. I still recommend the book highly. There's much to be gained from it. There's some good stuff in this book that I've not seen elsewhere. There's some valuable things in it. Schools that follow the pattern suggested in that book will no doubt be superior to many of the typical American schools around the country. So I'm not saying that what they're doing is bad made it clear earlier, I don't think what they're doing is wicked and wrong, but I don't think what they're doing is inferior compared to the general level of education in America today. At the same time, I do believe that ACCS schools should be strongly encouraged to stay the course on this point. So having examined it in the early history of Logos in one setting, having become aware in our studies that Sayers was giving us an insight, not historical exegesis, at another stage, and having read Little John and Evan's book at the third stage, I think I've weighed and considered what they're arguing for, what they're saying, and I say, okay, that's a reasonable point. I can see how reasonable Christian educators could seek to make that point. And at the end of the day, I don't buy it. At the end of the day, I think that this application of the trivium to the ages of child development is a unique historical insight. And I hope that 500 years from now, school children and parents and board members will be blessing Dorothy Sayers for what she saw, what God gave to us through her insight. So at the same time, I do believe that ACCS schools should be encouraged to stay the course on this point. But of course, I would say that you don't work for McDonald's and sell Wendy's burgers. You know, this is what we're doing. This is what we are striving to do. This is what God continues to bless us with and through, and so we should be grateful for it and simply continue to labor in that field. Father, we thank you for your goodness and kindness to us. I pray that as we think about these things, that you would continue to bless us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.